Hi, it's Mike. Thanks for listening to the Thanks I'm Here All Week podcast. Now, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that this is not a podcast for the kids. This podcast will most likely contain some adult language and subject matter. Actually, trust me, I know all of the guests. And along the way, there's going to be stories of drinking and drugs and smoking and gambling and, of course, sex. And not necessarily in that order. Pretty much if you can think of a vice or a bad behavior, I'm sure we'll be getting around to it. We'll be touching on all of the seven deadly sins, and I wouldn't be surprised if we don't invent three or four new ones along the way. Some of the stories you'll hear happened in a time when public attitudes were not as open and accepting as they've come to be. Luckily, we've all grown up a little bit since then, and for the sake of these stories, we are going to try our best to be respectful. So with all of that in mind, I invite you to either run away now or sit back and enjoy. All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome. It's time for another Thanks I'm Here All Week podcast. My name is Mike Gigani. I'm your host, and I've never heard of you either. I'm excited about this one. This gentleman that we're going to be talking to tonight, we, of course, just like everybody else, we go way back.
Yeah.
And, we probably are embarrassed to say exactly how far, but late 80s, well, I think we met.
Yeah.
I'm introduced you to the great and the wonderful Kevin Rogers, folks.
Yeah. Good to be here, man. And I will also be here all week.
There you go.
And hey, you know what? I just turned 50 in February, and I'm proud of what we've done. I ain't shy about where we're at in life, and it's interesting, man. Like, who survived and who's thriving now, and who's stuck in various positions in life. Everybody's right. Journey is unique, you know, and right. Awesome, dude. The fact that we have friendships that have transcended maybe three decades or more in some cases is incredible.
Exactly.
I think it speaks to the bond and the unique culture that you're doing the show around.
Yeah, I would agree with that. In fact, just before I came up to start recording this, Teresa said to say hello to you.
She awesome. Said, yeah.
Give always remember best. Kevin was one of the comics that would talk to Teresa, not talk to Gigani's girlfriend.
Nice. Oh, yeah. That's lovely. Yeah.
She's always held you in very high regard, as I have. And
thank you.
I was thinking about the first time we met. We were both working Ron Bennington's comedy scene, Clearwater, Florida. I think you were underage probably at that point.
I was.
Yeah, yep. I was. You, me, and Lester Bibbs.
Oh wow! Yeah, that's right. You worked with Lester a lot. You toured with Lester. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Did a lot with Lester. Lester kind of had his own gravitational pull whenever he was in town anywhere. It was a party, and he wasn't at all a big drinker, druggy.
That's person. Right.
He just had that personality that drew everybody, and you wanted to go have fun.
I remember that. Yeah, he was one of those guys that seemed like he was a star whether the world cared or not.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, yeah. He had that, and it wasn't an arrogance, but he reminds me of like almost like an athlete. I would imagine like superstar athletes who are just young and they know they got it, and they have to have that sort of confidence to do what they do, and Lester just had that kind of presence.
Yeah, and I believe why I remember some details and everything. I think you and a guy named Gary Wilcox were switching up MC duties that week.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
and of course, yeah, that was a great club. Was that your home club, the one that you
it was?
Yeah,
so that's where I started. And I remember calling the club, Mike, when I was 18, because I was the funny kid in my group, and I was a high school dropout, and I was already getting restless about what the hell am I going to do with my life? Mm-hmm. And I was working at a detailing cars at a budget car sales place. So it was like retired rental cars they were selling. who could pass that up?
Yeah.
And I sucked at that. Yeah. I couldn't even clean a car good. I was already in my, I remember my job was in jeopardy, and I was like, wow, am I failing at life already? I'm barely 18. And so I remember literally from like the shop phone, I called the club, and it was Bennington's Comedy Scene, and it was Ron's partner, Scott, and remember Scott and Brett used to run the joint?
I don't remember specifically, but now that you're mentioning their names, it's ringing a bell.
Yeah, there were these great barfly guys. And anyway, so one of them answered, and I said, hey, you know, hey, listen, do I have to be 21 to do the open mic? He says, well, how old are you? I said, I'm 18. He goes, that's fine. He goes, just don't drink. I go, okay. No, it's legal now.
Yeah, turn around and run after you. Yeah.
And he goes, I go, okay, great. I go, how long do I get? Like 20 minutes? He goes, 20 minutes? You ever been on stage before? I go, no. He goes, you'd be lucky to get five. I go, what am I going to do in five? I haven't even been on stage. I'm negotiating with the guy. Of course, I go up in 3.5 minutes. Good night, everybody. I'm out of breath. I'm out of time. You know.
Now, did you prepare for the first time, or were you well, no, I'm funny. I can just go up there.
Was that your take? No. Yeah. I was the opposite. In fact, speaking of long friendships, I'm still friends with a guy who was, you know, part of the crew egging me on back then to do this, and he reminded me of a hilarious story the day I was going up for the first time, and I had like a whole table of friends there. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to rehearse for him and another friend of mine, and they were sitting on my couch. And he didn't tell me this until recently. He said, I told Frank, whatever you do, don't laugh. And so I'm sitting there running through my bits for two guys, and they're stone faced. And I'm like, finally, I realize what they're doing. I'm like, you dicks, you know, I'm like, this isn't funny. This is very serious. You're going to screw me up. And then they burst out laughing, and so good. You know, I think that's what made us, I don't know about you, but I've been around ball busters my whole life. And yeah. I think that's part of what is in a comic's DNA, to embrace that and find it hilarious, even if you're the victim of it, right?
And get to practice it after the shows at, you know, wherever diner or Waffle House you end up at, or, you know.
Yeah. Whatever, yeah. The best.
But it's funny you mentioned bringing a bunch of people to your first show. How did that work out for you?
Good. I mean, it was definitely, it helped to have them there. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you, I say this all the time, and you, I'm sure you get this too. People find out you're a comic and they're like, I've always wanted to try that. And when somebody says that to me, I look them very seriously in the eye and I say, well, now you have to.
Yeah.
Right? I say, mm-hmm. Because it's too easy to walk around wondering forever if you might've been good at it. And you're not hurting anybody by trying. It's not like you're going to screw up the band. It's you and a mic, and it's 5 minutes, and it might be torture for you and the crowd, but so what? It might also be amazing.
Yeah.
Because I knew in those like 3.5 minutes when I walked off that stage, I said, I will never not have this in my life. That's what I believed at the time. And I think you kind of know early on, right?
Right. It's funny because I've seen both ways when you at open mic nights where, you know, somebody come up for the first time, they pack the audience and have this stellar show, and they would come back the following week just cocky as hell, none of their friends were there, and they would eat it so big, and they'd almost be like in a fetal position in the back of the club afterwards. So easy, is it?
I did have a somewhat of that story where it wasn't the next time, but it might have been. I was hanging around the club a lot because I just loved the environment. And so Lou Angel Wolf was the house MC, and Lou had already kind of taken me under his wing a little bit. And I just showed up on a Wednesday and just to hang out. And I was surprised when Lou said, you want to jump up and do a set? And I was like, yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. And I ate it. I just ate it. And I came off stage and I was just flummoxed. And I said to Lou, I go, what the hell happened? And he goes, you phoned it in, kid. he goes, you got cocky. He goes, that won't happen again. I was like, that's some true words right there. That will not happen again, yeah. You know?
And you bring up something interesting. It gets in your blood very quickly. I can remember, just having this group of friends that I hung out with, did my first open mic night, tanked big time. Went back about a month later to see the show, and somebody said, are you going to do some more time? And I figured, I'm surprised you even let me in the building after that. Once I had my first good set, it was just all encompassing. It was just like, I have the night off, I'm going to the comedy club either just to watch or you see if I can get stage time. And it was just, grab whatever stage time you can.
Exactly. Yeah. That I just wanted to be around it. I just wanted to soak up the air of it. I'll tell you a funny full circle story real quick, without going into all the details. So I ended up retiring from comedy and I stay away for 12 years and I ended up coming back.
Right.
So, cause our friend Billy Gardell sort of challenged me to do it. I do it. And the minute I accepted that I was going to do this, it was right back into my blood, And I remember, so I went to a show that Ward Smith, I don't know if you ever knew Ward.
I did, yeah.
Local guy. So Ward was hosting it. Lou was on the show. And I'd been on stage like three times, literally in front of other comics. It was Coconuts on the Beach. And I knew I was horrible. I had to suck all over again to come back. Well, you came back. I don't know if you had that experience, but so Ward came up to me and it was that moment again. And he's like, you want to go up? And I had to say no, dude. And it crushed me. And I thought, you know what? Like, this is the magic of stand-up. These mere mortals are standing around this table being people, and they're going to walk on that stage, and they just have this superpower that you otherwise would never know about. Mm-hmm. The minute they get under that light and they grab that mic, magic happens. And I said, I hate that I gave that up. And so that motivated me. The fact that I had to say no, because I would have been terrible, and it was a full room. And so a year later, Ward was doing the show again. And I wanted so bad to have that moment back. I bought a ticket. I didn't even try to call. Well, hey, I think I'll come by. I wanted it to happen so organically. I bought a ticket and I went. And Ward's like, hey, what's up? And I was just waiting. And he's like, hey, you want to do a set? I'm like, yeah, sure, why not? And it was like, I got to relive it because I had it back now, because I'd worked hard to get it back after a year. And I had a great set. And it was just an interesting thing, because like you said, once it's in your blood, it's always in your blood, and it may lie dormant, but it's always there. And it made me appreciate all over again what a special, unique ability it is.
Yeah. It's funny. You had that connection with Billy Gardell. I had the same thing with Christopher Titus. He came through Richmond. I popped in the club and almost the same story. You want to do some time. And I hadn't been on stage in years. And he said, okay, but I'm coming back next year. You're opening for me. And I did a couple of open mics that just were horrible, to the point where I was thinking, I got to call Titus and say, you don't want this. But my kids were really excited about it, because they had never seen me other than this old VHS with me wearing the old, remember the Waldo shirts I used to wear?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. So it was great. Yeah. There was like this split second while they're doing my intro. I hadn't been on stage, in front of a real crowd, probably 18 years. Yeah. And they're doing this, my intro, and there's this 4 seconds of just abject terror.
Yeah.
And I'm like, am I really going to do this? And then once I got that first laugh, and Teresa will tell you, she says, she could see it click with me that I was just like, oh, okay, yeah, that's right, this guy. I remember him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Boom.
That little swagger comes back. Yeah.
And then you get the same microphone moves and all that. And then for 3 days, I was like, oh, yeah, I can start touring again.
That's so funny. That kind of happened to me. I got very fortunate. People would ask me, so I made the mistake of, because I'm used to a little bit like living, I'm not going to call it the public eye. It's on Facebook or whatever, but because I have a little bit of a following in my business and all that, I announced this, that I'm doing this thing. And so now my friends start buying tickets and planning to fly in my work peers.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, oh my God, I did not expect that. This is getting real. And I did start getting a little scared. But then I did it and it went fine. And there was a funny moment though, where the one thing people kept telling me, because I'd only worked the theater maybe once or twice, and this was a 2,000 person venue. And Danny Bevins specifically, who, do you know Danny?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, great comic. And yeah. Danny is a very loving mentor, and he mentors all these local comics, and he took me under his wing and really helped me like get back and form. And Danny kept telling me, now listen, remember, a theater's different than a club. The laughter takes a minute to actually reach you. And so your timing, you have to adjust your timing. And after like the third joke, I'm like, that's not happening. This doesn't feel a lot different than a club. Maybe I guess I'm not getting those kinds of laughs.
Now you said your home club was Bennington's in in Clearwater, I think that was.
In right? Clearwater, right. And
Tampa, Tampa, Clearwater, St. Pete, that whole area, there's like 9 cities. And at one time, there's probably 35 rooms.
It feels like it. There was a lot of clubs. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So did you go through that phase where you were hopping
a bunch of clubs? You know, it's interesting. Here's what happened to me. I got very lucky, man. About 4 months in, maybe 6, I'd become a staple with the open micers. Mm-hmm. And Lou, who was the house MC, was moving to LA.
Okay.
And so they held a contest to replace Lou.
Ah.
A single night, and Todd Yon was the headliner. And Todd was judging the contest along with Lou. And they told us, they said, if you go overtime, you'll be disqualified, because one of the most, if not the most important thing for an MC is to do their time and not go over and keep the time of the show. And I'm sure I was conscious of this and doing my best to keep time. But I had an okay set. I didn't like crush everyone else. Gary was on the thing and other people. And I won because I did 4:58 of the 5 minutes. Wow. And Todd was like, we have to give it to you. You know, yeah. Everybody else did like 5:10, 5:15. And so
you held to it. Yeah.
So that 2 seconds resulted in me being on stage 8 shows a week for a year straight.
Wow. Okay.
I didn't realize at the time. I just like lucked into this job. But looking back, and certainly coming back and seeing how hard these local guys work to get stage time now. They drive all over friggin' town to do these shitty one-nighters with 6 drunks and a TV on at the bar, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result of that, I didn't really work the other clubs. I didn't work the Hamlin's Landing, and I didn't work even the Coconuts that much, because I was busy. I was the house MC at Bronze, right. And that's what I did.
Wow. And that's a good gig, because it forces you to constantly write, because you probably have people that
a lot of people repeat customers
at the time, like 8-9 times a month.
Right.
People were going to the clubs that much.
Especially with Ron's following. Ron, remember, was a huge, huge star here locally on his radio show. And it was such a thrill to introduce Ron. The crowd would go nuts the minute I would start his intro and they figured out it was him. They would just, was like I was introducing the friggin' Beatles, you know?
Yeah. Now, that one week we worked together there, the first week we met, it was the big thing. I think it was like Friday night, Ron was coming in second show, bringing a guest, and he was going to do a set. And it was James Doohan, Scotty from Star Trek.
Oh, wow. I vaguely remember that. Yeah.
So he was in town doing
like a theater, like a
one of the shopping channels that was based.
Oh, right. Yeah. Your Home Shopping Network. Yeah, yeah.
That was it. And so he's there with these two guys, and me and Lester go over to say hi after the show and get autographs and everything. He invites us to sit down and have a drink. And I was never a big heavy drinker. Yeah, I, if I was, you know, close, walking distance of where I was going to sleep, I was so paranoid about getting DUI and everything. So the comedy condo for that club was like maybe a block behind the
right.
I like one of the only times in my life I got blackout drunk, and I just remember waking up the next morning and coming out of the bedroom to go get water to take my aspirin with, and Scotty from Star Trek is sleeping it off on the condo sofa. Yeah, so like, okay, wow. Yeah.
That's great. That's stand up in a nutshell right there. Yeah, like the brushes with fame are so minuscule and fleeting. You know, it's like, yeah, it's always like your story about a famous person is like, I kind of remember that guy. But to us, it's like, you know, dude, I got to tell you, you want to hear, I know you want some kind of somewhat wild stories, right? Oh, so yeah. Speaking of Vin, I don't imagine he told this one, but Vin Montello, who was your guest on the recent episode. So at that condo, all right, remember across the street from Ron's, there was the strip club, Sweethearts, right?
Right.
And you mentioned that I was underage. And so I used to, the only way I could go drink with everybody was if somebody knew me from the club. Yeah. Or somebody goes, oh, Kevin, he's on the show. And they'd go, oh, because I looked a little older. And they would just assume, of course, he's of age. And so I was always sneaking around. And if a cop would come into any place I was, I'd hide my beer or whatever. So anyway, we're over at Sweethearts. And one of the comics has this, I won't name names. We have to be careful, right? one of the comics has a girl with him. And I don't know where she came from or whatever. Right. She was very, very wasted. And so we're at the strip club and she's with us. And then at some point, Vin and I noticed she's no longer around. Mm-hmm. And Vin's like, where'd she go? I'm like, I don't know. And for some reason, we decide we need to go find her. Like we walk outside, dude. There is a man carrying her like Tarzan carrying Jane, walking away from this club, carrying her away, and we go, hey, and he turns and he walks back towards us still carrying her, and he just looks at us and we're like, what are you doing? And he goes, basically looked at us like, I found her, like, isn't she mine now? Like, and he, I swear to God, dude, like he just sets her down and walks away.
Somebody threw out a perfectly good woman.
Finders keepers, buddy. Like, why are you guys harassing me? So now suddenly Vin and I are responsible for this girl, this woman. And so we bring her back to the condo, and her and the comic she's with have this crazy knockdown drag out fight.
Right.
Everybody ends up back there, and she punches the window, sticks her hand, her fist through the window. Ooh. And slices her arm open. And is bleeding rather heavily, but she doesn't want anybody coming near. And so I don't know how Vin and I are like Starsky and Hutch in this situation, but we're both like talking to her like, listen, honey, you're injured bad. We need to get you help. So we put her in my car and we go walking into the emergency room. Vin is now carrying her like the guy was. She's right. Not wearing undergarments, a very short skirt, everything's hanging out, and we just walk in, and now we look like the crazy people like who found this girl, but except now she's bleeding. and we realize at this point, like, we need to just make sure she's in good hands and get the hell out of it. And we just kind of like put her on a gurney and say, what, you know, yeah. Here's her ID. Like, we don't know from here, but
we don't know who she is.
Yeah. Like, these days they wouldn't let you like turn and bleed. Like, no. We made sure she was okay. It sounds like a horrible story. And it was a horrible story, but those were the kind of nights, you know what I mean? That just randomly happened. Fortunately, there wasn't always bleeding people, but a lot of broken people in the comedy world. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. And a lot of times, the end of the show was really the beginning of the night.
Yeah,
we're talking about him like he's dead.
I know. What am I doing that? I literally saw him like a couple of years ago, and he couldn't have been nicer. Like, he made a point to we went up and had a quiet drink together and caught up, and he even said, come open for me, and it wasn't going to, but you know, it was really nice of him to, I guess, feel obligated to say those words. He's just a nice guy.
He really is. Yeah.
And I think you're right. He was a shift, but at the same time, we all did have this sort of attitude about the fact that he was the guy. Mm-hmm. It was fine when we talked about him because we knew. It was when other people heaped praise on him, I think, that we got annoyed.
Yeah.
Right? And I bet you were there. I'm sure you were there that night. Do you remember the Star Search audition in Charlotte?
Yeah.
So I never forget that. If people don't know, Star Search was one of the star maker things. It was literally what it was supposed to be. You could get famous in one of the categories. They'd have singers, and Sinbad got famous after Star Search. And
Rosie O'Donnell.
Yeah, Rosie O'Donnell, Scott won there. It was a big deal to win. You got like $100,000 or something. And so I remember, and literally Ed McMahon was there. You would think they just need producers. No, Ed's there. The place is sold out. And Ed goes on stage. And I remember he said, and tonight we might just find the next Carrot Top. And every comic looked at each other and like, fuck that. Not why we're here. We want to be the next Lenny Bruce, you know?
Yeah.
And dude, I remember watching all these great comics, looking back, it was my immaturity, but I saw these guys who could kill a room. Everybody had like, what, 3 minutes, right? And one after the other go up and do okay. And the reason they weren't killing like they normally would is because they were trying to do their, what they thought would be their TV set. And none of them were being themselves. And I was like, I don't know, 12th or something. Mm-hmm. And at this point, I remember thinking, fuck this. I'm not getting on Star Search. And I probably didn't prepare as well as I should have. So I'm just going to do my opening 3 minutes, and I'm going to swear, and I'm going to break all the rules. And all I want to do is kill. Mm-hmm. That's all I got in this to do anyway.
Right.
And I went up, dude, and I did. I had a really great set. And I remember Kevin Hughes coming up to me after the show, and he goes, I got to tell you something. Number one, you're not getting on Star Search. Really, no shit. He goes, number two, keep doing what you're doing, because that was great. And I was like, so like, he was a respected guy. Like, and he was like the only thing he'd ever said to me. And I was like, so I was proud of what I did, like the choice I made. But it was all because Ed McMahon said, tonight, you could be the next Carrot Top.
Yeah, I'm not going to tell the story now. You're going to have to wait till I'm going to have Jeff Chester.
Oh, man. I can't wait for that.
His favorite story, and I'm 99% certain that you were there for it, but it was another Search audition in Charlotte that Ed McMahon wasn't at that one, but I don't want to tell too much.
Okay, all right, all right.
There's more Jeff's story to tell because he brings it up every time.
So good. But, yeah, Jeff was so cool. It is so cool.
Yeah, I was thinking back about different times we worked together, and every time we worked together, you were harder and harder to follow. Mm. And so you say, you know, worked harder and harder every time we worked together. And I remember Joe Morrison always saying the same thing. I love Kevin, but he makes me work so damn hard. Mm.
What a great guy too. Man, yeah. He was so funny. So
I had met this girl in Orlando. We hit it off and everything, and she was from Tallahassee. And I think the following week I was supposed to work Tallahassee. And so she goes up there and she's telling all of her friends, I'm dating one of the comics from the Comedy Zone. So she's got this table, all these, you know, these Florida State girls and everything. And you were the opening act. For those of you who don't know Kevin, back in the 80s, he had just flowing black hair, just stud boy, just, you know.
The boots, the belt buckle, trying to be Jim Morrison. Bar,
you go up on stage, I look over at the table where my girlfriend and all of her friends were, and they're all like patting her on the back, like, yeah. And she's like, no, she's pointing over to me, and they're all like, Oh, okay.
Oh, that's great. That's so funny. Glory days.
Yeah. Now, another time, you know, this is after I had gotten out of the business and, you know, we were talking about you just, I felt like I was just so genericized. I was just doing what was going to work in the haha room in Little Rock. You know, what was just going to make people laugh enough that I got a good rating and I would get booked again, not really pushing myself. So I got out of the business like 75%. I was still doing weekend gigs. I got a real job. And I think I actually got better for a while because I was back to being a real person doing doing real people things. I wasn't, you know, getting in the car, eating a Whataburger at 80 miles an hour, trying to get to the next gig, and then, yeah, and drinking and sleeping till noon. Yeah, I was actually doing things that real people did and everything. Yeah, so I got to open for you, opening for Ray Romano.
Yeah.
And do you want to tell the rest
of
it?
Sure. I would almost love to hear your version of it more because I've told the story quite a bit. But it's here's my perspective of it. Mm-hmm. So this is the thing. And Ray had just gotten the sitcom, Everybody Loves Raymond, and he was out promoting it. And he was with his big shot manager, what was the guy's name? Rory something, or he was Brian Regan's manager, I think, for a time, or maybe still is. Anyway,
I don't remember the name.
Everybody knew it was an important show. And Ray was still a cool guy, mm-hmm. but you could see he had that star quality too on him, right? Anyway, so I open and I go up and I do my set. And I feel like I have a very good set. And I come off stage, dude, and no one is talking to me. And I, you know how it is when you know you had a good set and you just expect...
Yeah.
When the club owner walks by or the manager, he kind of gives you a little, hey, great job, a little nod, something. But it's almost like I'm blackballed. Like people are literally avoiding eye contact with me. Mm-hmm. And so I'm so now weirded out by this. I went up to the manager and I said, I go, of course I'm fishing for, I go, hey, it's a pretty good crowd, huh? Mm-hmm. He goes, yeah, you did great until you stole Ray's bit. And I go, well, what? And you know, Mike.
Yeah.
And this is why I tell the story with copywriting is that the worst thing you could be labeled with in comedy is a thief.
Yeah.
And of course, we all kept each other in check. You could not be a thief amongst our group of guys.
Right.
You would just not be allowed to hang out. It's just, you know. And so I said, what do you mean? And he says, well, that bit you do about the phone being in your head.
Yeah.
He goes, that's Ray's bit. And when you did it, he came up to his manager and he's like, that was my closer. What am I going to do now?
What am I going to do now? Yeah.
Yeah. And he's like, ah, don't worry about it. Just close with the other thing. And so, dude, I am on pins and needles and I'm watching Ray and he says goodnight and he sort of gets a little bombarded with people lining up to get an autograph or whatever. And, but we lock eyes, like, mm-hmm. and it's clear, like we need to talk.
Yeah.
And I just basically wait in line at the end of this line. And I go, I go, Ray, I go, man, listen, he goes, I know what you're going to say. He goes, and I want to tell you, I saw your whole set. He goes, I could tell you're doing original stuff. He goes, but that bit you did, he goes, is almost word for word my bit. And obviously I'd never seen him do the bit. And if I stolen it, I sure the hell wouldn't do it in front of him.
Yeah.
And he goes, I know you wrote it. He goes, it happens. It's happened to me. It's just sometimes, you know, he goes, but I've done it on Letterman. I did it on this. He goes, and if you keep doing it, people are going to just assume you stole it from me.
Yeah.
And I said, man, I appreciate it. Thank you very much. And I was just so relieved that he knew I didn't steal his joke. Mm-hmm. And then we had a nice chat and, he even took my number because I told him I just moved out to Hollywood and I was looking to try writing it.
Yeah.
So it ended well, but dude, for 40 minutes while he was on stage, I felt like my life was ending.
I remember that because I just see the roller coaster on your face. Oh. I mean, you had that set and you were coming down. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, oh shit. And then the relief afterwards.
Oh, it was brutal.
Why don't you tell us what you're doing now? Because it's funny. We kind of hinted at it before about doing stand-up, you know, obviously led to what we're doing, what we're doing now and everything.
Yeah.
In unusual ways, but maybe not as unusual for you though. But
well, yeah, I guess it, there are a lot of parallels. So what I do now is now I run a community and teach and coach and mentor people. Mm-hmm. But I spent 10 years as a freelance direct response copywriter. And so those are, you know, ads that are written in a way to get a direct response from people. And so it's measured advertising and, you know, you get paid based on how well it converts attention to action. And, but the miracle was even discovering that it existed and then realizing that, oh my God, this may be a second chance at being uniquely qualified to do a thing that this time actually might make me money.
Yeah.
Because the first time I was just going on instinct and like, you know, I went on that stage that first time and I was addicted and was fortunate. I kind of just kept lucking into scenario and working hard and doing everything you got to do, but definitely hit a ceiling and not knowing that I had any control. I didn't have Scott's marketing acumen or James Gregory's business sense. I didn't have any of that. I thought the fact that I hated when club owners started saying, well, you need a hook if you want a headline. And I was like, oh, I got to get a hat and a belt buckle. And you know what I mean? I'm not doing that. So I wandered for a year. I quit comedy and, I had no idea what I would do. I just knew that I was supposed to marry Michelle and thank God she hadn't found someone better before I just woke up and said, please, like, let's find out if we can be married.
Yeah.
And we got married in Chicago, moved back to Florida. And dude, I was working, I was a bellman at a hotel. I was doing all no resume jobs. You know, some places wouldn't even hire me to valet park cars.
Right.
Because the only thing on my resume was stand-up comedian from 1988 to 1998, you know? And they were like, well, I guess you probably are waiting for your next gig, you know? And crazy circumstances led me to understanding that there was this thing called copywriting. And I loved to write. I wanted to be a writer. I'd say about halfway through my career, I was like okay with not being a star or even...
Yeah.
I loved the collaboration. I love the stuff we're talking about. I loved the late nights at the diners and riffing and writing jokes and getting together with comics to write. And to me, it was like, if I could spend my life doing that. And anyway, so, you know, that's what I have now, essentially. And, and the thing that changed everything, put it this way, dude, I don't think I would have succeeded as a freelance copywriter if I hadn't failed at comedy, because it was like, all right, now the stakes were high. I had my second kid was just born and it was like, I'm going, it's very uncomfortable for me to sell myself and ask for, you know, what seemed like a lot of money to me at the time. And again, thank God for Vin Montello, who coached me through all that, because he was already good at it, because he'd been through the mill in Hollywood and all that, right? I just said, I can't fail a second time, because the stakes are higher now. It's not just this hippie comic who, you know. And so, yeah. So now, I mean, sometimes it's crazy that I have this great business and this amazing team that works with me and 1,000 members of my community who pay a subscription fee every month to learn from me. It's incredible.
Yeah. Wow. Now see, now I wish I could reach through the screen and slap you on the back of the head for say calling yourself a failed comedian.
Well, you're right. I mean, that's a little harsh, but I would say this, the fact that I think I had the necessity to file taxes 3 of the 10 years under some, you know, circumstances that would be considered a failure. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I went through, in fact, I definitely went through a major bout of depression after I stopped doing comedy. And yeah, you just didn't have that instant feedback and adulation 5 nights a week from people. And that's really difficult to get used to and all that. But then, yeah, and I did have periods where I was thinking, well, you know, why did I waste my time for 12 years? Or, yeah, I guess I was doing it 8 years full-time on the road. Yeah, it was a waste of time. I'd look at other people and go, well, yeah, look, they've got this big house and, and yeah, they started their career while I was off putzing around and everything. But now, yeah, everything was the line to get me where I am now, and I'm happy where I am now. You know, we both have great families and luckily there's social media. You and I lost touch for many years and now, you know, I feel like I know Michelle just because, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'll post something. There's the little thing.
Oh, she loves
you. Like this. Kevin,
I think you're her favorite person on Facebook. She always talks about how funny you are. Did you see what Mike posted today? All the time, dude. Loves it. Big fan.
Yeah. I got to get down to Florida sometime.
Oh, that'd be great.
Almost worked as Eric Godfrey's club down in St.
Oh, yeah. Fun club. Year. Yeah.
I was going to work
at Sanford or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to work that with, Russ Nagel.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And yeah, I forget why I had to bail out on that, but yeah, I haven't been to Florida probably about 20 years, but, I know so many people down there. I think I could probably go down there for 3 weeks, not see everybody.
Yeah.
But you're at the top of the list. Thank you.
My
sister-in-law, Michelle.
Exactly. Yeah. Dude, that would be a blast. Can you imagine how much fun we'd have a night with dinner and drinks? And I think, you know, God bless our wives, right? Like at least Teresa and Michelle lived it too, because she, you know, she's Ron Bennington's sister-in-law. And so I met her at Ron's club.
Oh, okay.
And so she really has been around comedy longer even than I have. And so her and her family really get funny, and they know all the players, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Jimmy Schuberts and the all these cats. And so I think that's part of a successful comic marriage, is, you know, they've got to have some insight, because if they just had to hear all these old stories and not have any understanding of how it worked, it might be torture.
Well, Kev, this has been great, man. It's great to finally talk voice to voice again.
Likewise. It feels like we never missed a beat.
Exactly. Yeah. So we definitely got to do this again. I'm sure we just scratched the surface, like I said, with Vin last week. And I want to do a couple of these where it's not just one-on-one.
I was going to say that, man. It's like, I don't know how we'd get, it'd have to be like a 3-hour show, but
yeah.
Oh my God, to get like Mike Nilsson and Vera Cola. Oh my God. Oh, I haven't talked to Charlie.
Well, cool, bud. Let's definitely do this again.
All right. I look forward to it.
Thanks again. And
all right, brother.
We'll be talking later.
All right. Talk soon, man. Okay. See ya.
Bye-bye.